Cable News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to Cable News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm joined today by Laura Grimes, the executive director at Oregon Arts Watch, to talk about all of the latest arts news. Welcome to the show, Laura.
Thanks for having me, Althea.
Yeah, thank you for being here. So lots of important things to talk about today. I want to dive into this first story here by Claire Willett. It's called Trump's Executive Orders and the NEA, a Detailed Timeline. So this is dealing with the National Endowment for the Arts and how already the Trump administration has been shaking things up, to say the least. What can you tell me about this one?
Claire did a great job of outlining all the details on this, which is that for starters, all the deadlines and guidelines suddenly changed on open grants. And usually when this happens, it's done on a future application cycle that isn't already public and people aren't already working on. So the fact that this happened in the middle of a grant cycle just wastes a lot of time when people have to, you know, change gears, pivot, figure things out, and kind of start over again. So the guidelines had been posted for months, you know, and they were live. So as and when it changes like that, it's sort of like it's like quicksand. You know, all of a sudden the whole ground shifts underneath the process. So in order to help with that, the deadlines were pushed back, which makes sense. And the NEA was really open about the new timelines and some of the other changes. But there were a couple of details that they were not as forthcoming about, and they really haven't been answering them. And so these national grants, which are very complex, the guidelines are usually two sets of guidelines, one for just the overall application and one that's more specific to the field that you're applying for. And these guidelines are like, for each of them is about 40 pages each. I have done these, and it's all in the details. You have to comb every single detail, because if you get something wrong, it could be that you've disqualified your grant application and all that work is gone. So it's really important to pay attention to the details. But what happened is that some of the grant writers discovered on a Friday night when it wasn't, you know, the NEA wasn't available to answer questions, that there's this one page called the Assurance of Compliances page, which has usually all the legal information and it never changes. And it's usually to make sure that the activity that you're wanting to be funded is within the law. So it's usually to make sure that the activity is accessible to people with disabilities in accordance with the Americans with Disabilities Act and things like that. So suddenly it was noticed on a Friday night that it changed. And what it was is that it added some language. Usually the language is that your activity can't be discriminatory, but then it also added that the activity also couldn't promote gender ideology, which is contradictory to the fact that you can't be discriminatory. So on the heels of that, there was a webinar that completely filled up really quickly. People actually couldn't get in, and then you could view a video of it afterward, but this whole issue about gender ideology wasn't addressed. And then a lawsuit was filed by the American Civil Liberties Union on behalf of four plaintiffs who are, for the most part, theater groups, national theater groups. And it was, the lawsuit is specifically focused on the executive order about gender ideology. And there's not even, you know, you have to read through between the lines. It's really about transgender, non-binary, and gender non-conforming artists, you know, the trans community as a whole. So once this came out, then it kind of made sense, perhaps, why this wasn't discussed, because likely the NEA knew that there would be pending litigation about this. And then, so the NEA dropped that language in the assurance of compliances. So continue, and then they pushed back the deadline again. So Claire outlines all of this in her story. She did a great job. There's going to be a hearing in the lawsuit. We'll continue to follow this story, and we have more writing in the works about this.
An aspect of this that I found to be interesting was the inclusions of the photos in the stories, which helped to describe which Oregon projects that people might be familiar with actually rely on NEA grants. It's not obscure necessarily. These are organizations or exhibits or shows that people might be familiar with.
Yeah, a lot of it, it's Body Box, Portland Center Stage, I mean, Profile Theater. We received an NEA grant a few years ago. They're spread around the state, and it's usually not all the funding an organization receives, but usually it can be significant. It can really make or break an event being able to happen. One of the grants was to the Portland Art Museum for an Africa fashion exhibit, and it was $55,000. I'm sure that was a really important grant to make that exhibit happen in 2023. So, we depend on these dollars, but we also, and we just kind of sometimes know what we're dealing with. It's the uncertainty and the fact that the ground keeps shifting that makes the situation so difficult.
Right. And I was also interested to learn in the piece that the NEA pays out grants as reimbursements as opposed to awarding the money up front, which can also make this more difficult.
It is. It's one of the few that does that. I've actually only encountered one other grant that has that process. And, you know, managing NEA grants is not for the faint of heart. There really is a lot of steps to go through, and you have to dog them to get that money. But it is doable. You just have to be on top of it. But it does mean, what happened for some organizations is that they had been told they received grants, but then the process is kind of stalled. So they're all in limbo trying to figure out whether they can proceed. You know, do they have that money coming in or not? Some had already applied for their reimbursement and were told it was coming, and then it was frozen. And then later unfrozen, but it's just been a really challenging situation for the arts community as a whole.
Well, to talk about some of the other stories that Oregon Arts Watch has out right now, Susan Subert's Fragile Beauty, talking about this photography exhibit, Icebergs and the Passage of Time. What can you tell me about this one?
Brian Libby wrote this story, and what I really, really appreciated about it was that it wasn't just about this exhibit, but he really profiled her long career as both a noted photojournalist and a fine art photographer. It was nice to see how this exhibit brings her two careers together. I followed Susan's work for a long time. And I was mostly familiar with her photojournalism career, and she has done editorial photography for National Geographic, National Geographic Traveler, the Smithsonian, New York Times, Travel and Leisure, and many others. And she's done that over a number of years. But I was familiar with some of her fine art projects, but not so much that it went back to her college days. I mean, she really intended to be a fine art photographer from the beginning. So that the story, you know, goes through her whole illustrious career. It was really kind of this nice little gift. She went to the Pacific Northwest College of Art, and she earned really prestigious internships with esteemed photographers in New York. And so this show, what Brian Libby talks about in the piece, is that the show almost seems like a passage in time. And the exhibit is about all of her work in covering the polar regions, its icebergs. She's been had a front row seat to witnessing climate change and how it has been melting icebergs. And that's what the exhibit shows, the icebergs. And so she's been a witness to that over the past decade there, and then a couple of decades as a photojournalist. So this is a real turning point in that she is stepping away from her travels with her magazine work and going to stay home more and work on her fine art photography. Her parents are getting older and the like, so she'd like to stay closer to family. And also these travel trips are just grueling. They're long days work. They're, you know, halfway around the world. And so I think she just kind of feels like it's time to stay here now. So this exhibit sort of marks a turning point for her. And I like how this exhibit brings together her dual careers.
The photography that's included in the piece is extremely striking. And it also, you know, talks about the emotional toll that it would take on a person to be right there bearing witness to the ice caps melting.
Yeah, I really appreciated how the story talked about the type of techniques that she uses, that when she does her studio work, when she's not out in the field, but when she crafts her studio work for her fine art exhibits, that she's always had this sense of having a strong social conscience. And she advocates, well, for instance, some of her early works were about domestic abuse, and she really champions people. So her work is very thoughtful, something to get into. And then what I was fascinated too is that how she uses these vintage printing techniques that I didn't really know much about. So I was very curious about that. I mean, she definitely has to bring together a lot of skills to produce this work.
Well, there's one other Oregon Arts Watch story we ought to touch on. This is from the Cultural Hub series. It's called Tolovana Arts Colony Nurturing the Cannon Beach Art Scene for 20 Years. Talk to me about this one.
Lori Tobias did this story. It's about the Tolovana Arts Colony based in Cannon Beach. And Cannon Beach is really known as an arts destination. It has a number of art galleries. It's home to a lot of artists. And what I liked about the story, it talked about what the Tolovana Arts Colony does, but it also talked about the whole history of the arts in Cannon Beach and why that's been important. There were a couple of artists way back in the 60s who were very community minded. It was a very grassroots effort, and they brought about sort of this sense of championing the arts. And both those people are gone now, but now Tolovana Arts Colony has kind of taken that up, and they have been around for 20 years. So it's a more organized effort from what it was way back in the 60s. And they have a number of programs that are long and varied. They have some of the events there at the Tolovana Hall, which is a city-owned facility that they run, and then many are held around town. So they cover art in a lot of forms. They attract artists, they attract big names, local artists, they attract people from around the country. They just had a comedy festival. And next month in April, they will have Get Lit at the Beach, where they bring in some big name writers. And it's really about writers and readers coming together in an intimate setting. And they attract some big names, both locally and nationally. The authors participating next month in the Get Lit at the Beach include Paul Sitonge and Renee Denfeld, who's going to be the keynote speaker. Joe Wilkins, Terry Brooks, who is a very well-loved fantasy writer for young adults. And so and I hear that, you know, it's just a real important writer, I'm sorry, important event for both the writers and the readers, because it really just focuses on that relationship. And then in June, they hold a fundraiser, which is a mini golf tournament around town and a silent auction. That sounds like a lot of fun. And then they have other events where they do art classes, exercise classes. And then in November, to celebrate Native American Heritage Month, they have what's called the Gathering, where they have a lot of indigenous activities. And they also host free concerts in the park and pop-up shows. So it was fun to read about all the things that this place does for Cannon Beach, which is a special beach town. But the story also doesn't shy away from the challenges that the town faces, with the dwindling number of full-time residents combined with escalating cost of living and high housing cost prices. It can make it difficult to continue something like this, but it also makes it really important that the arts bring people together and connect people.
If our listeners are interested in reading these stories for themselves and finding out more, what's the best way for them to do that?
They can read all about this news at orartswatch.org.
Well, Laura, thank you so much for taking the time to break it down for us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. I always appreciate it.
That was Laura Grimes, the executive director of Oregon Arts Watch, speaking with me about some of the latest stories from the publication. More information is online at orartswatch.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Dave Johnson. Despite all the attention given to Robert F. Kennedy Jr., President Trump's choice for Health and Human Services Secretary, many public health experts based in rural communities are focused more on the loss of healthcare infrastructure in the U.S. Ann Sosin is a public health researcher and practitioner based at Dartmouth College. KBOO contributor David Rosenberg spoke with her about the country's rural healthcare infrastructure before RFK Jr.'s confirmation.
You are concerned about the infrastructure in rural healthcare, and I'm wondering if that was a problem before the new administration, and if you think that it's going to get substantially worse now.
I have long been concerned with the shrinking healthcare infrastructure in rural communities. This was a problem prior to the arrival of the Trump administration, was a problem prior to the COVID-19 pandemic. Over the last several decades, we've seen rural communities lose their hospitals, their primary care facilities, their pharmacies, and other healthcare infrastructure. And what this means for rural Americans is they have increasingly diminished access to healthcare and the resources that they need to stay healthy, as well as to meet their needs when they fall ill.
What can be done about it on the state level, if anything?
So, you know, there are actions that we can take at a federal level, at a state level, and then also at a local level. These actions often are located at policy level. There are policy choices that can be made around reimbursement, particularly for Medicaid. Many rural hospitals are serving populations that are insured or more insured by Medicaid. And so those policy choices that are made by state lawmakers have enormous bearing on the viability of rural hospitals. So that's, you know, that's one place for us to look when we're thinking about states. But I'd also add that it's really important, particularly in this moment in time, that we all, you know, work to preserve the rural health infrastructure, that we recognize how important these facilities are, not only for the health, but also for the economic survival of our rural communities. Often rural facilities are seen as expendable, and many think that rural people can just get care at larger facilities that may be located far away. And so those ideas often lead us to think that it really actually doesn't matter, that it doesn't have consequences if we do start to close facilities.
And in these confirmation hearings for RFK Jr., has the issue of rural health care come up at all?
So I want to say that I haven't been able to follow the confirmation hearings closely, so I'm reluctant to comment on the hearings, but access to healthcare for rural communities has not been a point of focus in the discussion around these nominees, is to my knowledge.
Is there a better approach to this in other countries, as far as you could see?
You know, certainly there are many countries that do a far better job of ensuring access to healthcare for all of their citizens than the U.S., and also that achieve better health outcomes. Even though the U.S. spends much more per capita on healthcare, it underperforms its peer countries. And so, you know, I think there's much that we can learn from the rest of the world, both in terms of how to organize our healthcare system, as well as how to deliver care to rural populations. But that's not necessarily my area of expertise. And so, you know, I guess I'll leave it at that.
So during the pandemic, there were many online appointments, and I think some people do that anyway. Is that something that rural people can do? Or even if they can, is that really inadequate?
Yeah, I think you're talking about telehealth. And we've looked at this in our own research, and I've seen the use of telehealth in our rural northern New England setting. And what we saw in our early pandemic research is that telehealth is a promising tool for advancing rural health equity if it's embedded within a robust existing system of care. We saw that many people were able to access specialty care using telehealth, that the option of having telehealth increased utilization of behavioral health services. In particular, it can eliminate driving time for rural residents. That said, we need to make sure that the infrastructure is in place for rural people to be able to use telehealth. Many areas have very poor broadband coverage. Rural residents may have more limited access to devices. And so addressing some of those barriers to utilizing telehealth is really important. I also want to add that when most of us think about telehealth, we're thinking about patients connecting directly with providers. In our rural region, we also see the use of telehealth to support the delivery of emergency care, and that's provider to provider telehealth to support remote ICU care for critically ill patients. And so there are a wide variety of applications for telehealth in the rural environment.
Are there areas in the U.S. where the rural health care is at a higher level, would you say, that other areas can learn from?
Certainly. So I would say a couple of things. First, rural is not a monolith. There's significant diversity both across and within rural places, including within our rural northern New England region. The second thing I would say is that there are some common processes that have played out across rural America and in that have affected rural places in common ways. That said, there are common challenges in terms of delivering healthcare in rural places. And there are also places that have much more in the way of health infrastructure. Here in rural northern New England, we have, I would say, more infrastructure relative to some other parts of the country. We have similar challenges in terms of the delivery of care and population health, but there is a more abundance of infrastructure in this particular region.
And with the new administration and now in power, what challenges do you see in the area of rural healthcare?
I have not really seen a plan for rural health or rural healthcare from the new administration. Certainly, there are many reasons for concern, given, you know, the track record of the former administration and some of the appointees that we're seeing come forward. But I've yet to see anything that addresses the enormous needs of rural Americans in terms of their health, you know, or any other aspect of their lives, to be honest.
So it could be an issue that's kind of ignored or forgotten, do you think?
That is likely.
Any cause for hope or optimism in the future?
Yeah.
I mean, maybe there's some good, maybe some good efforts, non-governmental efforts. You know, there's community organizations that get together to provide health care, things like that.
So I see a lot of reasons for hope in rural places. I see the extraordinary work that's being done by rural healthcare providers, by rural organizations, by community groups. There are a lot of assets that we can build on in our rural spaces. We often hear accounts of rural America that center on things that they lack or on deficits. We hear very little about the creative and innovative work that is happening in many spaces. So that's, you know, that's a starting point. That said, there are, you know, enormous challenges, you know, facing the U.S. right now. Some of the things that we're seeing play out on the national stage are disproportionately going to impact rural people and rural places. And so we build on the strengths, but we also have to, you know, be attentive to the way that rural communities really stand to be harmed disproportionately by some of what we're witnessing right now.
Some of these communities are strong Republican areas, right? And would they then turn against the administration if their needs aren't being met? Or is that's too much of a speculative question?
So certainly the urban-rural political divide has been well documented, and that has developed over time. There's a long history behind the divide that we see between urban and rural America. And I think it's naive to think that that divide will disappear overnight and without sustained and careful action. While it's very likely that rural places will be harmed by some of the policies that are being proposed, I think we should not assume that the immediate response will be to turn against the administration or to embrace the Democratic Party. In my personal experience, I think many rural people feel invisible. They feel like their concerns are not heard or not represented by political elites in either party. There are sharp urban and rural divides. There are also class dynamics at play, and we need to listen deeply to understand kind of the source of those divides and those feelings and really think about what we can offer rural places in terms of a vision for the future, for their health, for their economic well-being, if we really want to change the current dynamics that we see.
Is there a category that you might call semi-rural, where it's kind of somewhere between suburban and rural?
So there are many definitions of rural. They're the two most common are the census and the Office of Management and Budget definition, and they measure rural places in different ways. And so different things get counted as rural under those different definitions, and that has implications for how we think of rural and we understand kind of different indicators of well-being in rural places. And so, and there are in some places, semi-urban or suburban areas get counted as rural, but and under other definitions, they do not. I'll also just say that, you know, rural again falls along a spectrum from, you know, the most remote places to larger towns that are located in more rural places. So there's not one singular definition of rural.
Yeah, I'm thinking of places, for example, in Alaska, where you could only get to by helicopter.
Yeah.
As opposed to places where you could drive to the next nearest city, although it might take you a while. Let's say you're a rural person, I don't know, in the middle of the country, and you need to go to a hospital. Are you saying the hospital might be, I don't know, 2 hours away and it might be too late to get emergency care? Is that one of the problems?
That's certainly the reality in some parts of rural America. Care may be a helicopter ride away, you know, not a short car ride away, but that's not the case everywhere. Remote rural Alaska is very different from a rural Vermont community that's not that far away from one of the region's academic medical centers.
Speaking of Vermont, has Bernie Sanders brought the issue up or any other representative from there?
Bernie Sanders has spent or has devoted a lot of attention to strengthening the infrastructure of federally qualified health centers or FQHCs, and is obviously, as someone from Vermont, very interested in rural healthcare.
That's public health researcher Ann Sosin speaking with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg. You've been listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Dave Johnson. Thanks for being with us.